Welcome to Beyond the Summit. This is Scalability's series of podcasts where we have some really interesting chats to some really interesting Northwest business leaders. If you want to hear more in the series, hit subscribe. And if you'd like to learn a little bit more about what we do, visit us at scale-ability.co.uk.
Welcome to season two of Beyond the Summit, Scalability's podcast, with me, your host, Ruth Wilkinson.
So I'm here with Darren Chasey. We are going to do probably a two-part podcast, but we'll see how far we get. For people that are going to be listening to this Scalability Beyond the Summit podcast, Darren, they may not know who you are. Do you want to just give us a bit of an intro to the life of Darren and what you've been doing?
Oh, yes. Depends how far you want to go back. I won't go back forever. So, yeah, I'm Darren Chasey, and I'm the owner or part owner of a company called North Star right now. North Star has got two legs to it. It's got a consulting and project management arm, which is my background, which I'll go into in a bit. And then it's also got a slowly growing hospitality business. We've just taken on the shipping at Caton, and I'm sure that'll come out in a bit. I live in Heysham, and I'm originally from further south in a place called Horwich, near Bolton. And I arrived in Heysham my family's been here for about 20-ish years.
Okay.
And I've only been here since 2020.
Late addition.
I had to come back a little bit in between. I spent my corporate working life working for Nissan and Renault in the northeast of England, and then in France, and then in various other places around the world. And then I spent the second half of that corporate life in the East Midlands in Derby, working for Rolls-Royce Aerospace.
Right, so we're going to come to some of that in a little while, because that's going to be of interest. So I've got a couple of questions for you initially. These questions are going to be based, I suppose, just to find out a little bit more about you, and then we're going to go into that background. And because often someone with a very strong corporate background doesn't always make the move to work for themselves. And I'd be interested to find out a little bit more about that as we talk later on. Best investment you've made so far, do you think?
And it doesn't, from a business point of view, Ruth.
Well, it doesn't have to be financial. It could be the best investment of your time. It could be best investment of your commitment.
Not in recent times. Probably the best investment I ever made in myself was going and doing a master's degree. Which I did at a really weird time in my life. 2002, 2003. I was about to start, and then my wife was pregnant, and my daughter was born early, 8 weeks early, which is when I was just about to start my course. I put it off by a year, I think, but then still did it. I was really busy at work. I had a big-ish and growing job at Nissan at the time, but it paid dividends as I went forward. I don't think I would have got the jobs I got after that without it, and I don't think I would have had the same level of combination of business confidence and intellectual curiosity, I'll call it that, without having done something like that. It was well worth it.
It's really interesting, that, isn't it? Because you tend to get two kind of thought camps here, with that some people, when they're in a corporate life and then they do go back to study, that there's two camps of, well, I just did it because, you know, I was asked to, or I was advised it would be a good idea. And they don't really see that benefit as much. And then you get people who kind of do it off their own back, who then do go and study and find it quite a transformative period of their life. Yeah. So you talked about you know, in the business side, what personally did that do for you then, having gone back to study? What was the outlook that changed, or the transformative piece for you?
I think it gave me an appreciation of what actually. So I think when you get a job in the world of in corporate world, and you look around the office that you're in, and you see the four walls, it might be a big office. My world started as a individual contributor in a room full of 150 people. And I kind of sat and looked into the corner, which is very typical Nissan office. The director of the area sits in the corner. And I thought, I want that job. Just general ambition type stuff. I want that job. And in your mind, you think, there must be something beyond that corner. But in your head, you don't really look because you're just in those four walls. So going doing that, it was a master's, it was an MBA at Durham University that I did. And once you go and start looking at all the other business functions that exist and all the responsibilities of those and accountabilities of those functions and how they connect together to help the business roll forward as a whole, you start thinking, well, there must be something beyond the four walls that I'm currently based in and I'm quite interested to see. So it gave me an appreciation of the wider business structure, which for me meant that when I finally made it into the corner and then made it beyond the corner into a different part of the business, it wasn't as much of a shock. You know, you realise that, oh yeah, all these different functions all exist because I've been in certain and studied how it all works and that sort of thing. So that was good. And it, weirdly, nothing to do with the course really, but I think the person sat in the chair in the corner can be quite scary. Mm-hmm. When you think about them being the boss of all those people, and you know, the only time you see them is, you know, I say not the only time, a lot of the time you see them, there's something wrong. But because you get that course allowed me the appreciation of what they had to do outside, when they had to go and talk to their bosses and their peers and everything else. And then when you go and do that with them, because you've managed to get outside of the walls and into a different part of the business, you realise that those people are just humans like mm-hmm. you are. And I think some people will find it frustrating, some people not. One of my traits as a person is I treat everybody as an equal. And everybody says that. And no one wants to turn around and go, oh, no, I go around pretending I'm better than everybody else. But when I'm when you're working with somebody, you know, whether it's your peer, your boss, someone who's in your direct team, you have to recognise that the job type, the inside the business, there is a hierarchy, and those are job titles. But that's just all about the accountability you've been afforded. But actually, those jobs are being performed by human beings. Just you're all exactly the same. And so I'm not very good at standing on ceremony or being overly deferential to people. And I'm even worse at trying to be somebody's, in inverted commas, you know, standard boss. Because I don't want people to think, oh, I can't go and talk to him about this, that, or the other. Because, you know, because he's on paper in some hierarchy or other, the boss.
Do you think then that culture is organizationally born, or it's the individual in the role that then begins that culture? So both positive and negative. So, you know, the leader that's always approachable, the leader that treats people, you know, in the way in which you would hope everybody should be treated. Does the business create that culture and put the right person in the role, or do you think it's the person themselves who breaks through that change? What's been your experience?
Well, I don't want to sound overly. I don't want to be negative, or overly negative about some of the organisations and the people within those organisations I've worked in. But there are some environments where my approach that I've just described, and we haven't got time now to go into lots and lots of detail or even stories about it to try and illustrate. My approach has not been standard, and in some cases has not been welcome. So from that perspective, you would say that the organisation, it can be restrictive and therefore doesn't allow people to be, you know, what they want to be. I think some implicit rather than explicit organisational traits expect you to toe the line mm-hmm. and fulfil the, you know, the cookie cutter mould of, here is what a leader or here is what a person that sits in this organisation should behave like, depending on what that level. So it's a long way of answering the question. I think it's a bit of both, but I think you've got to have a level of bravery, without making myself sound super special, to maintain your individuality and be willing to stand for who you are. Now, I personally would say that is a part of a reason I didn't go as far as I wanted to in my corporate career.
Okay.
I'm sure there are people who might listen to this and go, no, mate, it's got nothing to do with that. It's because you're an idiot or you weren't capable or whatever. But, you know,
the whole world's got an opinion, Darren. The whole world has an opinion at some point. Well, you know, and of which they are fully entitled, let me just add. However, it's interesting you say it, because I am in my life in corporate organisations, what I found when things were done differently, and certainly my experience when I did do things differently, and certainly in my latter career, I was really fortunate. Excuse me. I had a boss, if that's what she'd hate it if I called her that, who just gave you that freedom. She also gave you the freedom to stand by the mistake, by the way, which came down like a ton of bricks. But she also gave you the freedom to be able to change things. And I think the people that were the most fearful of that when it started to happen were in very senior roles rather than the people that you worked with day to day. It tended to create a little bit of angst further up that hierarchy. I think almost we don't do it like that. What's this person doing? And when I reflect on that later, was that because had that method worked, it perhaps would have asked a change of them to the way that they do things?
I think there's a bit of that. Some similar experience. I'm not a good person to work for people who are overly controlling. And I mean that in a nice way, as in that, you know, people are too, what is needed, I think, is important to, you know, either you set that direction or the organisation you work for sets that direction or sets that objective, I'll say. The how you achieve it should be down to you as an individual, and that the amount of autonomy that those people are prepared to give to you or us as in an organisation is a lot, it's heavily dependent on the type of organisation that they are, and there's an amount of learned behaviour and also confirmation bias around, well, I behave like this and here I am at the top of this tree. And therefore, the way to get to the top of this tree is by behaving like I did.
Yeah.
And that imprint is very difficult to shift, especially when you're talking to people who are very, very confident in their own position and, I'll say, in the small s, superiority. I used to work for a guy a long time ago, and he was a very clever, intellectually capable, emotionally unintelligent person. He was very sharp of mind, especially around numbers. Right? So you stare at a spreadsheet and, you know, blah, I know the answer, here it is. But he suffered from what I call cleverest man in the room syndrome, because he couldn't let the team or other people come to an answer. If he knew the answer, regardless of how it looked or played out in front of a team of people, he had to rush to tell you the answer. To say, look at me, I'm the cleverest man in the room. And I ended up having some fairly frank conversations with him, because I said, look, you keep suppressing the room, the team in the room, the dynamic, because you just keep jumping to the answer. Everybody's just sitting there waiting for you to answer now. And I said to him, you need to stop the cleverest man in the room thing. And he said, a flash chat, he said, but I am the cleverest man in the room. And I went, whoa, hang on.
Wow.
He said, I must be, look, the boss. And I started off on the shop floor, and everything I've done has got me to here. Therefore, I've got to be, haven't I? Otherwise, you'd be the boss. And I'm like, mate, really? Is that that's how you view your life? Is that the person at the top of the pyramid is the cleverest person there is, and can do all of the tasks and jobs of everybody else below them in the pyramid, which, you know, to that methodology, you know, not for me.
No, it's interesting. And I mean, I would hope it's moved a lot in general mindsets, but yeah, I still come across it in some organisations and often in some quite unexpected places, places where I expect it to be quite different. Best investment. Okay, so have we had a, what we could think of as a worst investment to date?
Oh, I've made some. Yeah, I've made lots of bad choices. And I'm worst is probably too strong. Most challenging thing I've done is the most recent thing is the pub. So taking on a pub in the midst of the economic turmoil in which we exist today.
And this is the ship at Caton.
This is the ship at Caton, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've gone in completely eyes open. It's a, you know, we know the world is difficult. But I don't think I'd appreciated how much time and effort it would take to start a business from fresh. So, you know, tiny bit of background, it was closed for quite a while. The previous occupiers had left for whatever their reasons. Business was completely shut down. And so we were effectively doing a startup of a pub stroke restaurant in a smallish village in just outside of Lancaster there. And you know, we did all the pre-planning was all good, you know, all the spreadsheet work was good, the business case was good, all the things that I would do naturally as a you know, a business professional, call it that. All of that side of it was very, very good. We planned and spent time and effort thinking about marketing and all the things to make sure that people knew we were there. I mean, not you know, we've got a business plan, you know, we've got all the stuff set out, we've got supplier relationships, but the avalanche of, right, here is a bill for that, here is a bill for that, here's some cost of this, here's some staff issues, here's some unexpected expense, here's some customer complaints, here's some, you know, all this kind of stuff has been very, very challenging. I don't regret it by any stretch of the imagination, because, you know, it's a good business that is currently lacking customers. Now, I know somebody might turn around and go, well, it's not a good business then, right? Now, accepted, right? And a tiny little diversion around, you know, some of the challenges. So I don't, you could probably offer half of our prices, drinks and food, and you still wouldn't fill it because there's just not the footfall at the moment, right? In small towns and villages. There's more in cities. But as an example, I went to London last week to go to a gig, called for a beer before the gig on a busy street in Kensington. Bought a pint for me and my mate. And the 2 pints I bought in London, which is meant to be the most expensive place on the planet, would have cost us a good 30% more than I paid in London if you bought them in our pub. And the reason for that is the fixed cost per pint in London, because the volume is down, you know, there's a couple of sips at the bottom and the fixed costs are gone. In Caton, your fixed costs are nearly half the pint of beer.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of challenges that, and weirdly, Ruth, when we first started going through the pub process, I looked at like a lot of people that take on pubs and think, man, they don't have mine and Dan's level of experience in terms of setting up businesses and doing this sort of thing. How on earth do they get through this whole process of setting this up and getting it running and make money? And that's before you even think of the challenge of, right, you know, how come London can sell beer cheaper than Caton, right? Because everybody knows, if you watch the news every day, that apparently London's the most expensive pet place on the planet. So and I'm not just basing that on one pub. I went to two and had a different, slightly different price, but still the same experience. And then when you weigh all of that up, you know, anyway, so I'm rambling on about the world of pubs. Not the worst investment, it is the most challenging investment.
Yeah. And it's a really good way in which you summed it up, though, when you said, you know, it's business, but it's not, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, without the customer, but or the right amount of customers. But that's in its early stages, isn't it? So yeah. it's the other part, isn't it, then, around the holding the nerve part? Because if you're going to make something a destination venue, and Caton is a destination place, It's beautiful. You can walk the dogs, you can do the canal, you can go for a cycle. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful part of where we live. But those things do take time reputationally.
Yeah. Yes.
And also there's a community there that you need to bring along that journey, whilst I hate to use the word, with you at the same time. So
yeah.
So in your kind of planning of that process, is there a thought that says, actually, I'm not even starting to worry just yet. This was in the plan. We know it will take a while to embed. Or has that also been a surprise to you?
No. So was it, I think the surprise has been the variability in footfall. I definitely knew there was going to be a time to embed and a time to build up the business and get a reputation. You know, we've changed fundamentally with the offering of that pub. You know, we've upped the food by a couple of levels. We've broadened the drink, you know, the drink offering by a couple of levels as well. And we've done a little bit of decorating and stuff to try and make it feel more like a slightly more premium offering than it was before. So we knew that was going to take a little bit of time. But the surprise has been the variability. You know, so there was obviously a rush of excitement in the summer when we opened, and it was all very, ooh, lots of people came in to have a look at us. And it's just been up, down. It's really hard to plan because you look at it, after a couple of months, you know, which is the quietest week in the month because of, you know, pay cycles and various other things that happen. So you can start to plan for a little bit, but then you kind of go, next week is the quiet week. And then suddenly you run off your feet.
Mm.
Right. So we've now got a staff challenge because we need to try and make sure that we can cover it. So then you plan for the following week when you're normally busy and it's dead as a doornail.
Mm.
So that up down nature, and it's not, I take your comments, Ruth, about the location, the destination, all that. So it is there, but it's kind of up, down as to the volume of people that you can get. Now, the challenge, I think, is making sure that the local community see the ship as a place where they want to go and spend their time and their hard earned cash, you know. And we're getting there. No need to panic at this point in time. We're making a lot of plans towards the spring, summer next year. We've got some external renovations to do to try and increase the outside space offering a little bit. And we've got a new set of food events planned. So yeah, until I pull every lever, I will never declare it a miss. And we've still got levers to pull.
Yeah. And there's an excitement in that. And there's also just a holding head in hands moments at times, isn't there? There always is as part of that process. Like you say, it's
not as
predictable as maybe people think it can be. So an entrepreneur, it's one of the things that we talk about on this podcast is what is an entrepreneur? Because everybody has a different view.
Yeah.
Some people don't like to even consider themselves an entrepreneur. Some people don't even think it's a thing. What's your take on that?
Good question. I've got some friends who live in Nottingham. I probably about twice a year I go down and see them for a beer and a chin wag. They're both chartered accountant type people. One of them's got his own business. He builds spreadsheets for people. The other one does some. She's a finance director somewhere. And we were sat having a drink. We were talking about the business stuff that I've been doing. And my friend said, "Oh, who's your favourite entrepreneur?" Oh, well, that's an odd question. So I'm going to say me, right? Because just thought it would be a laugh. And he was indignant, right? He went, "You're not an entrepreneur." I said, "No, well, explain. Why am I not an entrepreneur?" He went, "No, an entrepreneur is someone like, I mean like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates." And I'm like, "Right, well, first of all, I'm not even sure that they're necessarily entrepreneurs because I don't know how much of their own passion, livelihood, they started risking. They might have started off, Elon Musk's dad had an opal mine. I'm fairly sure that he had some financial cover. I'm not sure of the others, and I don't think they were, they weren't old and mortgaged and married and, you know, with all these dependencies that I'm currently sitting with. And
didn't have the hand down the back of the sofa trying to find the last bit of change, did they? Most definitely not.
So that, yeah, you know, and so in that exchange, I was thinking to myself, I was actually only having a laugh. I wasn't necessarily, wouldn't necessarily think of myself as an entrepreneur at all. But I thought to myself, when you asked the question, I was like, yeah, of course, take the risk. You know, I had no business, and then I had a business, and then I had another business to add on to it. So there's got to be an element of being an entrepreneur in all of that. But I wouldn't class myself as that necessarily, but only because I've got no negative nor positive connotations other than I'm not the biggest fan of Elon Musk, but that's a different conversation altogether. It's not for his entrepreneurial
spirit, no, not his fan. No. I think there's many of us have perhaps just watched that car crash in very slow motion of recent times, yeah. I think. Yeah. I mean, that leaves at a good point. So you were at Rolls-Royce and then, you know, North Star Projects is created. I clearly have you know, skipped quite a few parts of that process during that announcement.
Yeah.
But how did that come to be then? What was the moment that said, I am going to go from a nice job with a seemingly very well-established business, which will have had the pay, the benefits, the pension, all the things that come with being, you know, very much embedded into a role in a good company, to I'm going to let all that go where I haven't, you know, a sense of, let's say, certainly a diminished sense of certainty in my working day.
Yeah. Right. So, potted history. Before I went to Rolls-Royce, I was working in France. By then, it was a Renault-Nissan alliance. And my boss left and went to work for Rolls-Royce. He wasn't a person I particularly knew that well or had even worked that closely with. And you know, he did the usual goodbye and off he went. And not long after that, I get a phone call from an intermediary of his at Rolls-Royce. He wasn't allowed to ring me because of whatever non-compete clauses or whatever. And said, with the logistics and supply chain, which is my bag really, is broken. Can you please come and fix it for me? And I thought, brilliant. I've been working away from home for quite a long time. So I've been in and out of the country and spending weekends, occasional weekends coming back to the UK and seeing Claire and the kids. And thought, oh, well, back in the UK, that'd be all right. Maybe we could move to Derby. There was a little bit of me thinking that. And then a little bit of me thinking, yeah, I like a new challenge. That'll be fun. And I think the pace of change or the pace of promotion, even for me personally at Nissan, had slowed, and I wasn't satisfied. So I thought, I'll go. So off I went, and spent 5 years there, really quite enjoying it. I fixed what I needed to fix, and I established what I needed to establish, and I made progress there from a career perspective. So that was nice. And then at five years in, I was like, right, next please, and I got stuck. Now, the company had I don't want to breach any kind of confidentiality, so you might just skip a bit of this. But basically, I tried to leave for 5 years, and was kept being told, no, you can't go. So I was, because there were severance packages on offer, and I kept saying, I'll have mine, please, and they said no. You know, so I'm brutal when it comes to that. I'm not leaving without my money. That's that ain't happening.
Yep. Well, that's just good financial sense, Darren. Yeah.
So I eventually, when the time was right, they said, yes, you can go. And so I'm sitting there now with, I've got a payoff, which would have seen me right for a reasonable chunk of time. And I was thinking, well, what to do next? I've completely had enough of corporate life. I'm a little bit bored of the, you know, right back to the beginning of our conversation, having to behave in certain ways and being treated as some kind of outsider because you don't. So I was milling around looking for something, and I'd been working with Dan, who's my business partner, he'd been a consultant for us at Rolls Royce, and we were just chatting one day, and we said, I said I might try and do consultancy, just me, because I had a reasonably good network at that point in time. And he said, well, why don't we do it together? We could set up a joint practice. He's very much, you know, projects and sort of stuff, and I'm much more about leadership and strategy and all that kind of thing. So it was a reasonably good mix, and we get on well. So I kind of went, yeah, let's do that. And we, so it was as much as I've got a safety net, so I don't need to rush. I'm also probably overly confident in my own capability and marketability that I thought, maybe it don't work. I'll just go and get another job. I don't necessarily need to earn the same kind of money I was earning at Rolls Royce, because, you know, I'm older now, and that's the way life goes. I'm a big believer from a money perspective, it's all about the mass accumulation of more and more and more. That's just my personal ethos, making no judgments on anybody else. So I don't need bazillions of pounds and this and that. It don't matter to me. I'm sure some people would say, well, that's an easy thing for you to say, because you've probably, you know, you've got most of what you need, most of what you want. I haven't actually, but that's a different conversation. So yeah, I've always fancied being like having a business of some sort. We took on the pub, you know, we've been looking, going into pubs and restaurants and being all, well, if this was mine, I would do this and I would do that. And I would like, you know, so, okay, well, if you're going to be that brave, crack on, put some money down, let's see how good you are. So there's a bit of that.
It's a really good point that you make there, because last week when I was speaking to Matt Jackson of Lancaster Brewery, he also hates the term entrepreneur, can't bear it. You know, he's been C2 investments for 20 odd years. And I said to him, so what's the difference then? Lots of people, and I literally said exactly what you did. Lots of people sit in a pub or an ice cream shop or whatever it is and says, I could do this better than this, but they don't. And I think his answer was balls and the ability to take a risk. And that's kind of where he couldn't really put his finger on. He certainly didn't want to be an entrepreneur like you. It was drive. It was, I think, capacity for risk. How much are you prepared? Yes. How much are you prepared to take? Because everyone can take a risk. It's the capacity, isn't it, of how much of that it is, or how much you want to mitigate, whichever.
It is. I sorry to interrupt. I think one of the, and I'm sure somewhere I could dig out the whichever theory or philosophy or writer or whatever put it. Yeah, I think there's two issues with risk, aren't there? There is the likelihood of something that's going to happen, and the impact of something when it does happen. And that, I think more people overestimate the likelihood of something going wrong,
mm-hmm,
because of the size of the impact that it does. So, you know, it's a catastrophic outcomes of things make you think, oh my God, I don't want to do that because it would be such a catastrophe. Where actually the risk of failure is infinitesimally small. Flying is a fantastic example.
Yeah.
You know, lots of people are scared of flying because, you know, if the plane crashes, you're going to die.
Mm.
That's, you know, the ultimate end, you know, ultimate bad thing to happen to an individual. But the chances of dying in an aeroplane are tiny, tiny, tiny. So that's a similar conversation here with the, you know, taking a risk with the business perspective. It's not a tiny chance that you will fail, but as long as you know what you're doing, and as long as you can do all the things that you know you need to do, and you're willing to put the work in, if it fails in the end, and you've done, you know, you had a great idea, and you tested it, and you talked about it, and you made sure that it wasn't just you, you know, imagining the world should have this widget X that nobody really needs. As long as you then sit down and do some planning, and then crucially talk to other people and go, well, I'm going to do this. Is this going to work or what? Once you've done all those things, and then once you're in it, as long as you don't, you know, the times when I'm most irritated with myself is when something goes wrong because I've not done what I said I would do. Not that I've not anticipated the next curveball, because crikey, who can, you know, if you could anticipate all these things, you wouldn't be, we wouldn't be having this conversation, would we? You know, I'd be living in a palace somewhere or whatever. So, you know, anticipation of, I mean, awareness and the things, that the range of things that could go wrong, it's important to have a, you know, a mind over. But when you get tripped up by something that you couldn't possibly have foreseen, then that's, you got tripped up, you know, that's life.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. There's an element of all of those things could happen to somebody. They could. But yeah. Which of those are within your control and which of those ones aren't, it is it's probably a different conversation altogether.
And that's the end of part one for our episode with Darren from North Star Projects. My thanks go to Darren for taking the time. I look forward to welcoming you all back to listen to part two.